drawing the wrong conclusion. This was a huge concern for the African American History Museum by the Smithsonian. They spent a long time trying to figure out how to do it well. And so I think, I don't know if I have any other than like hindsight's 2020 of who else we should have invited.
I don't know that they've done it well either. I mean, I think sometimes it's chaos. Different museum, sorry.
I'm thinking of the one that was just opened.
Yeah, the Native American Museum. They did the same sort of thing, the guided pathways. And there was so much conflict between the voices of the tribal members and different tribes and council, the tribal councils and stuff, that it ended up just almost being chaotic. Because there was just too much disagreement.
The voices in the exhibit or the voices in the community?
The voices of the community.
Debate?
Yeah, the community was very involved in the design of the museum. And it's really funny because you can tell when you go into one museum, you have a guided pathway through the content. But when you go into the Native American Museum, it's like you come in and there's like a million pathways to take. And it's very interesting to the different feeling you get. You don't know where to go.
Which museum?
The Native American Museum.
National
Museum. Yes, National
Museum.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think about my experience there and if I noticed. So which one has the guided pathway and which one doesn't?
Most of the Smithsonians have guided pathways.
But
that
in the African American History Museum, you're very much on rails the whole time.
Yeah.
Like it is you start at one place and you
IKEA
walk
style.
Through the,
you
yeah,
can't
it's
get
IKEA
out once you start.
Right.
And they use lighting and there's all sorts of physical ways to lead you through the exhibits.
And they've intentionally
designed know where to go.
That you will see this before you see this other artifact, because if you see them in reverse order, there's a high likelihood that you might trivialize the experience.
It's a story, it's a narrative kind of process in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it walks you through the storyline. Mm.
But that also, feels at odds with my interest in sharing the data and the kind of digital humanities and opening up this space where it doesn't have to, putting it purely on rails is a multimedia version of a monograph, which seems like
boring.
Yeah.
But I think, when you're talking about the general public, I think that's a lot of what people want. When you're talking about scholars, it's totally different, right? You have two different audiences. Mm-hmm. And I think the general public, and as being a library, they don't want primary source material necessarily. They want to be told what does this mean? Why is this important to me? What story does this tell?
Yeah.
And they want to be told that story.
Yeah, the other challenge with that is, from journalism research, the more linking out you can have, the more you build trust in your narrative and in your credentials as the storyteller, whether that's journalist or researcher. Mm-hmm. So it's like striking this balance of, you need the links to the primary material for gravitas sometimes only, even if people aren't going to want to click on them, but if there's some question of, there's like...
Yeah, I think you still provide the same sort of context and information to the public who may or may not want, they might want to just follow the storyline or they might want to dig deeper, and that's, as long as those are, like the annotations and there's information. I think sometimes the visualizations I see often don't have enough context and information to understand what they're trying to tell me. It's like I get confused about, what is this trying to show me? Because all I'm seeing is flashing colors on a map, and I don't.
Right.
What story is that telling me?
So increased annotation to help that narrative
pathway. I think
pathway.
That narrative pathway is really important, because I think the visualization alone can't do it, do it sufficiently. But I do think that you have, again, there's another side that's a more, I'm thinking about our library, where we have an exhibit gallery there where we tell these narrative stories and we walk people through, and then we have the collections, and you can come look at all the collections, you can look at all the primary source materials and do your own research and come to your own conclusions, or you can go down and see the conclusions that our curators came to.
So then the question is the relationship between those. So do we build just the either single threaded or perhaps two, three threaded? I wouldn't go too far, because you know, hyperlink literature and the attempts to make like things like Scalar, they end up making artifacts that no one really knows how to navigate, right?
Yeah.
So we're keeping it narrow. Mm-hmm. But when you build that apparatus, then is the researcher access just the raw data? Or is there some other interface? Does that interface somehow power both? Is there a way to build an interface where you have kind of a forward-facing and a back end that, because
yeah, I think
there's also the level of access and technical competency, because a lot of the scholars that we might want to look at it and draw conclusions for the research may not, if you give them the raw data set, start running named entity recognition over it and pulling things out, right? And so that's also a balance in terms of not just...
I would think you could build an interface that functions in different ways using the same data and same tools, but has slightly different functionality.
Building as an engine of sorts.
Yeah.
How does that fit with the discussion yesterday about the importance of including illustrations and discussing the relationship between the text and the illustrations? Because that came out as something that a few people flagged as quite important.
Yeah.
And I agree, I'm not sure how it fits with this idea of the three levels of kind of guided pathways, training wheels off, and data repo.
Now, you can use the illustration as examples to highlight your point.
Right.
And show that the example of the snake is fantastic again. To show, look, this is what in the guided pathway, this is what the data. I've analyzed the data, this is what it tells me, this is what it looks like. You can make diagrams of it, and you can have the illustration next to it and say, look, the illustration will tell the same story as a diagram. It's the same analysis.
Mm-hmm.
The illustrations helps you to make your point, help you to make your argument. That's the whole corpus of text is biased towards French background. The second thing is you say, look, we cannot analyze all 10,000 illustrations. But if you analyze the text in according to what we discussed yesterday, it is very likely that these are the results, and that's what you can publish.
Yeah.
And then based on that, you can say, look, if you want to draw your own conclusions, the data is here. And the illustrations
yeah.
are there. But with the caveat that the illustrations are not, I only use as illustrations as support for your argument in your pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, look, analysis of the illustrations is a completely different additional task. We haven't done that yet. We focus on the text first. And based on the text, we can draw these conclusions.
But that does suggest, so on the one level, so this kind of threaded, pre-baked kind of, this is the narrative, we can pull the illustrations and build annotations with the illustrations in it. But does suggest that in the researcher access end of the engine, that it should be forcing a display of the original page that the text came from at all times, because you want to see, I mean, right, if you're a researcher, you would want them to confront the image in situ. You wouldn't want...
No, but that's with the data access. So you'd have to have your original data.
Yeah.
With minimal annotations.
Right.
You have your text with your annotations, your recording, then you have the original scans with the illustrations, original page scans with the illustrations. There's four different types of data you start from.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to have them as a, that's your repository, right? That needs to be fundamental in as basis of your the whole website, the whole interface.
But if you're building some sort of presentation layer that's geared toward researchers, should there be a pointer between the original scans and your annotated, or even annotated?
You just different files or different areas. See them as different rooms. So if you want to have the original text, you go there. If you want the illustrations, you go there. And if you want to have the scans of the whole pages, you go somewhere else. But then you have the PDFs only, and what do you do with those?
Yeah, different viewers.
Can
show different views of the same text and
mm-hmm.
you know, layers where you show the page image or you can show the encoded text or you know you can have just a viewer for the images on the side that's pulling, you know, the tagged images out. And there's a lot of different ways you could design it.
I mean, based on yesterday's discussion, I'm realizing that it seems like it might be feasible to do some kind of training of a like neural network on the images using a kind of faceted, you know, getting the devices like level. I don't know.
We would need much higher scans, quality scans.
Yes,
Not yet. Your base material was poor scans based upon microfiche. That's your one link. If somebody wants to have better scans, higher quality stuff, that's their problem. If you you extracted the text from that, that's the second file, text only. The third one is the cleaned up version, probably, with minimal annotation. The fourth one is the complete annotated version. And if somebody wants to deal with that and say, look, the quality of the illustration is not good enough, well, your problem to go to France and scan the whole stuff.
But was it you, Kenny, or Mary, who was saying it's quite likely there may be higher scans?
There might be, yeah. I mean, it's worth asking, because a lot of that, those early scans have been redone. They just haven't necessarily been.
But it's a question of if it's available, then that's. Should it be predicated on? I think what Carol's saying is no. Like, if we can't get access to the ones, if it's not easily accessible, then. It doesn't need to be a pre-qualification
of
the project.
I mean, your scans are already, the images are already tagged in the text you have, so you know where they are. If you can get, you know, a better quality, what you would want is a grayscale version of the microphone scans. But you still have the location already, right? You sort of know where they exist.
Yeah.
So you could replace them, you could use, there's IIIF technologies that could help you in replacing images. And
I mean, and probably, yeah, and if the BNF has those set up, you know, in the server, you could just grab them
in
the IIIF manifest.
But the
thing is, like, there's a lot of the pictures that are completely black, but not all of them are, and I'm pretty sure you could get decent results with, like, is there a human body in this picture?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
So the question is, do we want to?
Yeah,
like
that. It depends on what you want to do, right? Does that matter for your research question?
Yeah, how important is that for ethical visualization of this corpus, I guess? And the discussion yesterday seemed to suggest it's more important than we thought and more feasible than
we
thought.
Well, it also gets to kind of a deeper problem that I think most digitally made projects wrestle with, is how much do I want to target it at my specific research question? And how much do I want to build a tool set or some sort of kit that someone else could just use to come up with something wildly different? I don't think the field of digital humanities has decided on what we're supposed to be doing with our time and resources. I mean, the one risk is there are projects that were made where it's like, I'm going to build this thing where you could then make your own conclusions from it, and then it doesn't travel. Right? There's no intervention into a scholarly
There is no one who
scholarly
wants to make
debate.
Their own conclusions from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
I think you have to imagine who, you have to find who your real audiences are.
What's your,
you
what's,
can't just imagine them.
What's
yeah.
been your experience of that with your work?
my experience is that the people who run the projects that I work on just imagine that there are users out there and there aren't actually users out there.
Have you worked on projects where there has been like a concrete audience where we're like, oh, these are the people, even if it's not necessarily known at the beginning or not necessarily who you thought it was?
There is an audience. It's very small. So for example, two projects, the French book trade and Enlightenment Europe project, has a lot of people who are all historians of 18th century who want to look up book sales. There's a couple hundred of them. They do very targeted searches. Sometimes they use it in their classes to teach something about book history, right? But there is not a crowd of thousands of people out there who are exploring this website and teaching themselves new things that they didn't know and didn't know that they should want to know about the French book trade. The French Revolution speech database has a slightly larger audience, but again is very scholarly and again, it's a research tool, right? They want to be able to do keyword searches for text in these speeches that otherwise they would have to go look through these giant 19th century volumes that only a few institutions have. So it's a very practical thing. And we just changed the entire interface for that, and that's when we discovered there were certain things about the previous interface, which had its own problems, which is why we were changing it, that they liked, and now a new one doesn't have these features, and right, and they're angry about this. And so, but that's literally the only time that there has been interaction with users. When the first website was designed, they interviewed about 10 people, including me, and I was one of the people who made data for the website, so that seems somehow not appropriate. Right, so there was not a lot of user testing, and they made something that made sense to the library developers and not to the scholarly community. But the scholarly community got used to it over time, and then when you change it, there's contention. So people get used to things. And if it's a reference resource, like the French Revolution speeches, then you have a larger, if you pitch it that way, then you create a kind of audience of people who use it in that way instead of going to the stacks.
I think, so there's a couple things that what you said made me think of. One is that one of the problems is that digital humanities is trying to short circuit the long established pathway from what we've found out to how it eventually trickles down into the society. So right now, I publish a monograph, some scholars in my field read it, they change how they say it, eventually it might make its way into a textbook that eventually convinces someone convinces the Texas Board of Education to adopt, and eventually people find out about it. And it's this very long kind of tied into publication history and politics in the US. And there's like this urge in digital humanities to say, let's skip all that and go right to the public. And the public isn't interested. And so a lot of these projects get built and then they don't speak to anyone. Or they get built and they presume a level of technological competence or skill on the level of the scholars using the interface that isn't there. And so this is another big concern. I guess this is maybe the ethical use of resources and spending money, but building something that has an impact at the same time, instead of just kind of presuming this, I can skip over this whole long, convoluted, ridiculous political process of how historical information finally winds up in the public consciousness. It's the if you build it, they will come problem.
Having built these things over 20 years, we have a lot of experience with this. And the audience is really important to use, like who you're aiming it towards. And the biggest use case we have for our website when we digitize a collection and contextualize it is not scholars, because scholars want to do their own, you know, analysis and contextualization. But for like K-12, those are the people who use our sites. If we're lucky, a professor will use it for an undergraduate education, you know, like for a course. But it's very rare that they will use it for a higher level course, right? You know, because usually that faculty member will want their own research to be part of their course, is my experience. Mm-hmm. And they don't want it packaged for them,
well,
unless they're working with undergrads.
One of the problems here, though, is language, right? And so French language resources are not pitched to an American audience easily. and I think if being able to always go back to the source material is a core part of however you visualize it, it may all be very well to have a visualization that's in English, but the material is in French, and so therefore your use audience are people who read French.
Right.
And that is an inherent limitation then in any kind of public facing intentions.
So bilingual interface is like
essential.
But that's another audience question too, is do we target this at a French francophone audience exclusively? I mean, even the way historians of France in the US, we write our monographs, we write them with an eye toward the relevance to America today. Like, even though we're talking about France, I mean, there always has to be a punchline in the conclusion about why X, Y, or Z academic living in the United States now should read this. You know, and the target audience isn't just a, you know, English reading francophone audience. So like, that's another balance issue.
I mean, should it be francophone audience or should it be French audience? Because like, to play devil's advocate now, a terrible question has popped up in my mind. So if we're talking about audience and why motivations of like why a scholar would want to use it, like if I'm a like post-colonial theorist in a former French colony, like why do I need to use our tool to discover that French people like to talk about themselves when they're talking about this country? You know what I mean?
Mm.
Like we could be amplifying something that doesn't need to be amplified.
I mean, my scholarly interest in the question is around the idea of what does it mean, like how does an empire without an emperor at its head that roots itself in ostensibly republican values maintain itself? And I think that is one that has a lot of currency for the US today and its role in the world. And I think that would be, if I were to highlight a thread about the imagined geography and the role in which kind of culture plays in maintaining oppressive regimes around the world in the name of the civilizing mission or in the name of spreading democracy, X, Y, Z. I think that's what's most relevant, and I think would have currency to K-12, right? But at the same time, then, these are French language sources in a different context. So how do we, you know, if I'm not well positioned to make an intervention into French K-12 or French primary school.
Yeah, no, I would go with Chris and say we have to target a francophone world in the sense that it's not only about France, it's also about the people the French colonized. And that's a huge geographical entity in which you can put countries such as Senegal, Mali, Algeria, Morocco, the two Congo, and so on, Madagascar. All of these places France colonized would be interested.
In terms of targeting an audience, how do we make it relevant, though? Because there's such a like big disciplinary and cultural differences between all of these places, and the more we target, I agree.
Yeah.
I just don't know how to get audiences who regularly use it.
Yeah.
Like that.
That's a good question.
Buy Hulu ads.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I still go back to your grant proposal, which says we're going to create a corpus.
Yeah.
It's clean, marked up, you know, available for researchers to use who do work with French language materials and who are looking for this journal, this text corpus to work with. So that needs to be one product that you're going to create, where you present it, whether as a data archive, you know, scholarly publication, whatever it might be. I think that's really important. But yeah, you have to think really hard about what your audience is going to be for your analysis, because if that's one of your products, your analysis, then you have to understand who's the audience you're going to be projecting it to.
I think the question too is, you know, yesterday we lived in a world with no limits of funding and time. but in a world where there are limits on funding and time, is it worthwhile to build a scholarly engine of sorts? Or should the time be spent building the intervention, like would be a monograph, and then the corpus that's annotated, and is not in any kind of dynamic environment. I mean, I guess the question there is it worthwhile to serve the 100 scholars or an even smaller subdiscipline, 10 scholars who would want to use this? Because it's a colossal amount of time and resources to build that middle layer. Whereas when you're building the visualization in the form of kind of say a story map or kind of more interactive journalism, you don't have to build a visualization that is all-encompassing and fully powered, right? It can be more targeted and specific to the thing you're trying to show at that moment, which could be reproducible to a certain fashion, but doesn't have to be everything to everyone. But that middle layer does. And if that middle layer is going to reach the smallest audience, does it make sense to spend the most time on it?
I think it's tremendously risky to spend a lot of time on infrastructure or that kind of middle layer, because it is an incredible investment of energy on your part, and it really presumes that there's going to be an audience that uses it. I don't think you know that yet. I don't think any of these projects that create these kind of websites really know that.
Yeah.
Well, and then from a sustainability point of view, too, it's like, you know, you can build it today with the current tools, and in 5 years, you're going to have to revise the entire thing.
Yeah. I'm thinking here of like, Laurent Dubois worked on the project Musical Passages, which is very linear. It's basically just a kind of interactive story with the music. I mean, there's no kind of Omeka layer that's exposing everything behind it. And that seems like, if that's all anyone's going to end up looking at anyway.
I think of it like a publication in a way. You know, it's like you're going to do this publication, but you're also going to, you're creating a corpus that other people can work with.
So the guided pathway through a more training wheels on visualization, think of that as if it's a publication.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the result of your analysis of the materials you've developed, right? Your work on that corpus. And then make the corpus available for others to use. Minimally encoded and whatever versions you want to put in.
Also the whole discussion, that's the second article, is the whole discussion about the ethics. If you have a corpus, any corpus, then this is a perfect case study, how to approach a corpus like this, make it available, have a whole discussion on paper that we just have. So that's why spending a lot of time on making it available, developing the tools for other researchers, or see other researchers globally who might use the tools in the next 3 years, is not really worth it. That's why we didn't do it. We could, but we didn't. There's just a whole ethical discussion of if you interpret the data in an unethical way, in an incorrect way, you could get these results. Just show them how dangerous it is if you visualize it the wrong way. And then show, you don't have to go to the obscene levels, you just say, look, that's acceptable. That's what we think is acceptable. Just nudge it a little bit further and say, look, this way over to the limits already.
And anything beyond that is egregious.
Yeah, but you can say, look, even you can make an example, say that your red blood dripping thing in Florida, that's unacceptable. It's just plainly unacceptable. It's wrong in all accounts. You can show that, and you can explain why that is wrong. And that will be very valuable for other researchers, because you don't have to have the whole discussion again. Because you can just say, look, I agree with that. That's why I'm going to make the interface for the 5 researchers who are interested. I'm going to apply for a grant for that. And then you really help research forward.
So you're saying make an intervention into digital humanities, saying, essentially explaining the conversation we just had and saying why they shouldn't be spending all their resources building these complex tools that...
You're just saying that that's most likely the most expensive tool for the least number of people.
It's the most expensive tool for the least number of people with the highest propensity for misinterpretation.
In the not-for-profit tech sector, there's an increasing amount of data-driven, design-led teams to solve problems in social problems, or that are kind of tasked initially with a data visualization problem, but inevitably more and more end up being a series of community events or flyers with text on them they're data driven, but the user testing shows that a chart didn't do what they wanted, or an interactive visualization. So there is the option, as I mean, applying that to this setting, you know, potentially.
Because let's go back to K-12.
Yeah.
If you have your data set, your analysis, scientific analysis, publishable in proper journals and so on, and the ethical discussion about the way these data sets can be used and misused, and you have a flyer for K-12 students to say, look, anything you read, however difficult it is in French,